Hi, I'm Armin Alney, host of To The Point in Which Way LA, and thanks so much for listening to our programs. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film awards season, I've got a podcast for you to check out. It's called The Treatment, hosted by Elvis Mitchell. He goes beyond the plot to understand what inspires the actors, the filmmakers, the producers, and others to do what they do. You can find The Treatment on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
A psychedelic revival in modern medicine. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The overuse and abuse of LSD, magic mushrooms, and other hallucinogens in the countercultural 60s led to a federal ban signed by Richard Nixon in 1970. Nobody says it's time to tune in, turn on, and drop out again, but researchers around the country report that psychedelics have real medical benefits after all. They've eased the anxiety of terminal cancer patients and helped suicidal veterans with PTSD want to live again. But the risk of adverse side effects has medical authorities preaching caution about continued experimentation. Today's talking point, nightlife returns to the streets of Baghdad. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To The Point. Psychedelic drugs declared illegal at the end of the 1960s are now turning out to have medical benefits after all. We heard about the results of recent studies and the controversy over continued research with LSD, ecstasy, and magic mushrooms. Today's talking point, the government of Iraq has lifted the nighttime curfew imposed 12 years ago by U.S. invaders in Baghdad. Bars, nightclubs, restaurants, and beauty salons are now facts of life in addition to car bombs and militant extremists. First, this news update. President Obama has not issued a national security strategy since 2010. Supporters and critics have been eager to see a new one. Today, the White House released an update, and National Security Advisor Susan Rice went to the Brookings Institution to talk about it.
We focus every day on the crises in the Middle East and Ukraine. But we are simultaneously rebalancing to the regions that will do more to determine the course of the 21st century. East Asia and India, Sub-Saharan Africa and the Americas.
Sean Brimley was director of strategic planning during the first Obama administration. He's now director of studies and executive vice president at the Center for a New American Security. Good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me.
The president has taken a lot of heat for not having a strategy. He's been accused of ad hocracy and improvisation, according to a story that you co-authored. Is this a response to that?
I think so. I think this is an administration that has frankly been struggled a bit with what we call in Washington, you know, the tyranny of the inbox. First, it was the Islamic State, then it was Ukraine. The persistent challenges really across the world. And so I think this was about time for it to come out. It's been in the works for a long time. And I think this is an administration who's struggling to sort of get beyond that tyranny of the inbox and have a more strategic view, or at least be in a posture to be able to express that strategic view to the American people and to key allies and audiences abroad.
Well, we just heard Susan Rice talk about the Middle East, Ukraine, East Asia, India, Sub-Saharan Africa, and the Americas. It sounds like she's turning over the pages in the inbox.
Yeah, she's trying. I mean, it's a hard job, and I don't want to be too critical because, you know, this is among the most challenging sort of security environments we face, and the American people, and frankly, some in the media expect the White House to have very sophisticated strategic responses to literally every crisis that they see on the news, and that's a real challenge to figure out what's important, what's less important, and what can be sort of punted down the road.
Well, how important then is this national security strategy? Does it really tell us what the president is, how the what he's basing his thinking on?
Yes, I think it is not a strategy in the sense that, say, a CEO or a small business owner would think of a strategy, right? A real strategy is, here's what I want to do. Here are the objectives I need to accomplish in order to do that. And here are the investments I need to make, or the hard choices I'm going to make to be able to free up the resources to be able to do these things. So this national security strategy is not that. It's not a very detailed blueprint by which you can read and figure out exactly where the administration is on each issue and exactly the hard choices they're prepared to make. It's really more of a vision. It's really more of a long, long, long speech that deals with American foreign policy and national security. And it's not unimportant. There are key allies and partners around the world, even our adversaries, who really pay attention to what the commander-in-chief and his staff think about the world, think about the key issues, and their sort of vision for how America will act in the world and advance our core values and our interests overseas. So it's not unimportant, but it's not a blueprint for action the way that some people think a strategy should be.
What do you think are the most important points? I understand you got an advanced copy.
I did, and I read it. And to be honest, there was a lot here that was evocative of the previous national security strategy that was released in 2010. Often, for second-term administrations, their national security strategies aren't sort of earth-shattering because they've been in office for at least 4 years. In this case, here's an administration releasing a strategy after 6 years. And so I wouldn't say they've advanced the ball in terms of, you know, saying new things. It's really almost a justification for what they've done over the previous 6 years. But there are a couple of things in particular in the president's foreword that he signed himself. He talks about the challenges we face require strategic patience and persistence. America leads from a position of strength, but this does not mean we can or should attempt to dictate the trajectory of all unfolding events around the world. And I think what he's trying to do there is to signal, hey, the United States is a global leader, but we have to, you know, keep our powder dry and be very prudent about where we make investments and where we, in particular, use force. He's getting a lot of criticism for not intervening in Syria, for not intervening more aggressively in Ukraine. And here's a president basically saying, look, you know, you got to make hard choices. If we intervene everywhere all the time, anytime there's a crisis, that's the end of us as a superpower. So I think this emphasis on strategic patience is something new, and I think it's something useful.
We just have seconds left. Is he still committed to a two-state solution for Israel and the Palestinians?
Absolutely. Susan Rice was just asked that question at the Brookings Institution in Q&A, and she was very strong on this point. So this is something where I think, you know, the administration's been very consistent across the board. And obviously there's some controversy with Bibi Netanyahu coming to Washington to speak to Congress, and we'll have to see how that plays out.
All right. Sean Brimley, formerly with the Obama administration, now at the Center for a New American Security. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
In a moment, a psychedelic revival in modern medicine on To the Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Since 1970, psychedelic drugs have been banned in the United States, even for medical research. But in the past 10 years, exceptions have been made, and the results have created a growing movement for conducting more studies. Tom Schroeder is former editor of the Washington Post magazine. He's author of Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. Tom Schroeder, good to have you on our program.
Well, thanks for having me.
A lot of terms that come out of the past if you were kicking around in the 1960s.
Well, I was kicking around really more in the early 1970s when I was a college student.
Okay. So tell us a bit about the acid test and what so far are the results showing?
Well, what happened was that in the 50s and 60s, this is after the discovery of the psychoactive properties of LSD, psychedelics were seen as a revolution in psychiatry. And it was being actively used to treat all sorts of psychiatric conditions with great success. And then when it got out into the counterculture and became a street drug, there was this huge reaction of society, and it became very stigmatized to the point where it stamped out scientific research almost completely. One researcher told me it was almost as if psychedelics had become undiscovered. But a group of people continued to see the value of it, and they didn't want to give it up. They didn't want to go underground. So they kept pushing, and they finally decided that they had to use science to persuade the powers that be that it was worth continuing this investigation. And the science in the 50s and 60s was a little bit sloppy by today's standards. So what has been happening over the past, really over the past 30 years, it just didn't get any traction until about 10 years ago, is that they've been doing good contemporary science. And what they found is that a range of psychedelics have been showing huge potential to be effective in conditions ranging from cigarette and drug addiction, alcoholism, post-traumatic stress disorder, even autism, and it even in healthy people has been shown to create experiences that would be called mystical type spiritual experiences that these subjects rated as the among the most important experiences of their lives.
I understand that people fearing death from terminal cancer are among those that have been treated with psychedelics.
Yes, and what happens is that they have these mystical type experiences, which gives them a whole new perspective on, and usually what it does is it shifts the focus from, you know, oh no, I'm going to die, to I have some time left, and basically I'm in the same situation I've been in my whole life, which is I know I'm mortal, I know I'm going to die, but I have to appreciate the moment, and I can appreciate the moment now thanks to this experience that I had. And that's the sort of benefit that they've been finding, and they've used both psilocybin and MDMA, which is also known as ecstasy, for that purpose. And now there's even a pilot study using LSD.
You mentioned the mystical experience in a very positive way. That's one of the things that was regarded very negatively at the end of the 60s when Richard Nixon signed the law banning psychedelics.
Yeah, Nixon famously called Tim Leary the most dangerous man in America. And I think that, I think that our culture has always found these mystical experiences to be somewhat threatening in as much as they sort of seem to be non-rational. And yet, when they've done these studies and these people who have said that they've had mystical experiences, then they have this way of following up on them and noting positive changes in their lives. And what these experiences do is they do tend to shift values around to things that I think everybody would agree are positive values, you know, where they're, you know, taking care of themselves physically and mentally, caring for their families, you know, their ratings of happiness have gone up. And so I think that, you know, spiritual people through the ages have had these experiences, whether they were induced by chemicals or whether they happened spontaneously. And, you know, they've given up addictions. They've sort of gone from being people who were trouble for society to being people who are very helpful and positive in society. So I think that that's actually seen as a very good thing.
You mentioned Tim Leary, Richard Nixon's most dangerous man in America. He's the former Harvard researcher who was fired after he became famous for saying, tune in, turn on, drop out. He was one of the sort of leaders of the counterculture and very much discredited at the end of the 60s. Again, we're talking with Tom Schroeder about his book, Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. Let me introduce Jennifer. That is a pseudonym. Jennifer is a participant patients in a study of MDMA, that's ecstasy, in Colorado. She is the survivor of both sexual and psychological abuse, emotional abuse from the ages of 2 to 20. She's now 30. And Jennifer, you're very kind to be on our program, and thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, of course. I'd love to be able to share my experience.
Tell us about it.
Well, where would you like me to start? I mean, I guess you already said I suffered a lot of traumatic abuse, and I would have to say that this is definitely the most amazing thing that I've ever had happen in my life, this opportunity to be in the MDMA study. I don't qualify for having PTSD anymore. I started out with severe chronic treatment-resistant PTSD, and then when I got into the study in December, I went through my first two live sessions with MDMA. Those ended up being comparator sessions, which are sessions with a very, very low dose of MDMA. After that, I was able to have three full-dose sessions, which, I mean, it's a totally different thing than the comparator. It's so much more support, and I was able to work through, I mean, years and years of trauma and just really come out the other side.
So this is something then that you discussed with a guide or a therapist while you were under the influence of the drug?
Right. You're in the therapist's office. It's set up, and you have two therapists there to guide you and support you through, you know, just working through the trauma.
So you say you don't qualify as having PTSD anymore. That's a wonderful thing. How would you describe the change? What were you going through before that you're not going through anymore?
Oh my, you know, so many things. Before I was stuck in fear. I was afraid of everything. You know, I couldn't drive. I couldn't go out by myself. I couldn't order my own food. I couldn't make phone calls. I was afraid of people. You know, I didn't feel like life wanted me here. I was afraid that, you know, I was this thing that shouldn't exist. I don't feel like that at all anymore. I'm in school. I'm taking 18 hours a semester, getting straight A's, you know, working as hard as I can to become a psychotherapist, to be able to help people the way I was helped. You know, I talk to people now. I'm super extroverted. I create. I'm an artist. I've found that I have a self.
What about the continued use of MDMA? Well, do you feel that you need it in order to stay in this new, wonderful condition that you're in now?
Absolutely not. No. My last session was in April, and it doesn't leave you with that feeling. You are left feeling like you have what you need, like you are able to support yourself. You have enough of yourself and you're whole enough that you don't need any outside anything. I don't even go to therapy anymore.
Again, Jennifer, describing an extraordinary experience, is a participant in the MDMA, that's ecstasy study, in Colorado. I want to introduce Charles Grobe. He is a professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the Harvard-UCLA Medical Center here in Los Angeles. Dr. Grobe, good to have you on our program.
Yes, hi. Good to meet you, Warren.
Is what we're hearing from Jennifer typical of people who have been through this treatment?
Well, there have been a series of studies now looking at the use of MDMA in the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder over the last decade, and the data looks very promising. They've been able to maintain good safety parameters, and their treatment outcomes were quite impressive. Their studies are being published in the mainstream psychiatric literature. So again, we need to study many, many patients before we can come to definitive conclusions. However, so far, things are looking very promising.
What sorts of obstacles are there to further study? The drugs are still illegal, are they not, under federal law? They're
right.
Schedule I drugs, just like heroin and, of course, marijuana.
Right. These research studies have to be looked at apart from the recreational use and abuse. To be able to conduct these studies, one has to get regulatory approval from FDA, DEA. California has its own in-state regulatory process, and then hospital, IRB, research committees. There are many levels of approval one has to go through. But we have established, and our colleagues elsewhere, that it is feasible, it's possible to get such approval. And then the next very important kind of factor to take into account is funding. It's been very difficult to get sufficient funding to push this field ahead in a more vigorous manner. For the most part, there has been no federal funding. It's all scraped together from private sources, which can be very painstaking, take some time. The two major organizations involved in helping to develop and fund these studies are the Hefter Research Institute, that's H-E-F-F-T-E-R, as well as another organization called MAPS.
What about the drug companies? Are they expected to chip in? Or because, as we just heard from Jennifer, it may be that you don't need to continue on the treatment, does that drive them away and suggest that they might not be able to make a lot of money?
Yeah, there's really been very little interest coming from the drug company, and I think you've identified the problem. This is a treatment model which might necessitate the administration of the drug on only one occasion or a handful of occasions over time within the context of an ongoing psychotherapy. So there's very little profit for the drug companies to be made, and there's very little interest that they have registered.
Charles Grubb, again, at the Harbor-UCLA Medical Center. You're a professor of both the psychiatry and pediatrics.
Right.
Does this have special application for children?
Well, these research studies are with adult subjects only. In our society, children and adolescents would be the very last patient or subject population to look at. I would be reluctant to generalize to a younger age population. Right now, we're just looking for markers of safety and efficacy in adult subjects.
Let me go back to Tom Schroeder, our first guest, the author of Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. We heard from Dr. Grobe that it is difficult to conduct these experiments because, of course, of the law. Is there any move in the Congress that you're aware of to try to lift the ban so that we could find out if more people could go through the transformation that we heard about from Jennifer?
Well, I think that will come about if these studies continue, and when they get into the phase three studies, if it proves that this can be efficacious for a large number, and we're talking about several hundred subjects rather than the, you know, couple of dozen that do them in these smaller studies, then the next step would be to get it reclassified, taken off of the most restrictive Schedule One. But let me just say that it's not just the law that's the problem. There's still a stigma to people who say they want to research psychedelic drugs. The stain of the 60s is pretty indelible. And just to give you an example, the Pentagon has maybe as many as 500,000 returning vets from Iraq and Afghanistan that are coming back with severe PTSD that's going to affect them an entire lifetime. And between disability and health payments, we the taxpayers are on the hook for maybe $1 trillion over the next 30 or 40 years to pay what we owe these soldiers who are coming back, so handicapped. And so you would think that they would see a potential treatment only takes a few treatments and has such great effects, and they would want to hurry it up to get it to market. But instead, it's been very difficult getting them to sign on. And to date, even though they're beginning to at least talk with these researchers about maybe sort of getting involved somehow, but to date they haven't given one dime to developing this treatment. And there's still a stigma. When I went on a show once to talk about Acid Test, the producers asked me to try to get somebody from the Pentagon to come. And through an intermediary, a highly ranked Pentagon person said, "Oh, no, this is too dangerous for folks in uniform."
Wow.
And he meant it was dangerous in the sense of their careers.
I hear what you're saying. Let me just indicate we need to go to a break. We'll come back and continue this conversation with our current guest and others as well. On our talking point later, car bombs and ISIS fighters are still facts of life in Iraq, but the government has lifted a curfew, and nightlife is returning to the streets of Baghdad. We'll hear about that. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking today about the renewal of medical interest in psychedelics, including LSD and ecstasy and others that still have, according to Tom Schroeder, our first guest here, the stain of the 60s on them, particularly at the Pentagon, where, despite the fact that veterans with PTSD have, in fact, been improved in somewhat the way that we just heard Jennifer describe, the Pentagon is not showing any interest at to say the least, and that saying that the careers of military people might even be hurt if they were dealing with these substances. Herbert Kleber is a professor of psychiatry and director of the Division of Substance Abuse at Columbia University. Dr. Kleber, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Are there good reasons for being cautious about going forward with further research with psychedelics?
You need to keep in mind that these are very potent agents. And that whereas some people have the kind of wonderful experiences that Dr. Griffith has described and Steve Ross at NYU has described, others get into big trouble. And part of the problem is that in the hands of less well-trained people, in the absence of guides helping people through the experience, and in the absence of careful screening of who they take into the research, you can have serious problems. So that as a scientist and researcher, I favor research, but you have to be careful. You have to also remember history. The history, for example, of Tim Leary was not quite accurate. Tim was a professor at Harvard, a very well-respected one. His wife committed suicide, I think by burning herself alive. He was so distressed, he left Harvard, went to Mexico, encountered psychedelic drugs, went back to Harvard, and started to experiment with it. And the university said, fine, you can continue it, but you have to promise not to give it to any undergraduates. And he broke that, and Harvard fired him. He was the first professor with tenure to be fired since the Civil War. And that's when he left Harvard. Ram Dass, who was there under a different name, quit when Leary left. And that's when Leary gets into the tune-in, turn-on, drop-out kind of position. And also remember, we were at that time seeing a number of adverse reactions. I wrote a paper in 67 called Prolonged Adverse Reactions from Student Use of Hallucinogens.
Describe the adverse reactions. What is this what we mean by a bad trip?
Yes. Yes, you have a student crouching behind a building, hearing footsteps come closer and closer and never arriving. And does this for hours until he's found by the campus police and taken to the infirmary. So that's one kind of serious side effect. You have serious side effects of individuals feeling, having hallucinatory effects after the drug is worn off. There have been suicides that you may be too young to remember. Art Linkletter, who is on the radio, I believe. His son committed suicide by jumping off a balcony under the influence. Now, remember, it's called suicide, but it doesn't mean the person was trying to kill themselves. Because as mentioned in the New Yorker article, one of the things that these drugs can do is take away the fear of death. And if you take away the fear of death, then you can feel, you can do things like jump off a balcony. Not be trying to commit suicide, but you can jump because you don't believe anything's going to happen to you. So on the one hand, I believe in doing research with these drugs. I think they're exciting agents, but we need very careful researchers like Roland Griffiths and Steve Ross to continue it.
When you describe the kinds of ill effects that have occurred, does that not depend to some extent on how big the dose is and on how pure the drug is?
Absolutely. And under what circumstances they take it. I mean, again, if you read the way that Dr. Griffith does it with careful guides and same with Steve Ross, these aren't simply people being given the drug and left on their own.
So we don't have either Dr. Griffith or Dr. Ross. We do have Charles Grobe at Harbor UCLA Medical Center. I take it that you are observing the kind of care that Dr. Kleber says is absolutely necessary?
Well, absolutely. You know, we're very careful to create the strongest safety parameters possible. It's a very, very contained, controlled context. And again, I think at the end of the day, it's very important to distinguish the treatment research that's going on from the more out-of-control recreational use model. And Dr. Kleber is right that there were severe problems in the 60s when the drugs got out into the society and were used by ill-prepared people with serious underlying vulnerabilities, often taking the drug in ill-advised contexts, mixing with alcohol and other drugs. In the research context, it's subjects are carefully screened, carefully prepared, carefully guided through the entire experience, and then helped with integrating the experience afterwards. And safety outcomes in our study here at Harbor UCLA and the Los Angeles Biomedical Research Institute, as well as at Hopkins at NYU, safety outcomes have been very, very strong. And there's an indication that we're getting good therapeutic effects. Although these are pilot studies still, there's sufficient positive observations, I think, to justify moving these studies forward into the future with more subjects.
Back to Dr. Kleber at Columbia University.
I should have mentioned you know, the work of Dr. Grobe, because I think,
sure,
again, like Roland and Steve, he is one of the careful researchers doing this work.
Well, let me ask you, Dr. Kleber, about what we heard from Tom Schroeder about the Pentagon. And if, in fact, as has been reported so often, we're looking at $1 trillion in public spending on veterans who have PTSD, wouldn't that behoove the Pentagon to take a closer look at this rather than to shun it as something that might actually make cause problems for military people being promoted?
Well, I think what they need to do is, or what we need to do as a field, is to come up with convincing enough data that they will do it. What's the old saying, being neither the first nor the last to try something new? So that,
sure,
I think the Pentagon tends to be a conservative organization, and they're not about to try this until we have enough data on large enough samples.
So then we're talking about what was referred to as phase three, where you actually need a couple of hundred people at least.
Yes, correct.
Let me go back to Jennifer, who described this extraordinary change in her life as a result of the therapy that she had with ecstasy. Jennifer, we've heard Dr. Kleber and everybody else, including yourself, say these are very potent substances. Did you ever feel that the drug had the power to cause you the kinds of problems that we've heard about? Was it really very important to you to have the guide, to have the environment that was conducive to your recovery?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely important to have that structured environment and to have the guide, you know, the whole way through it. I never felt like during the sessions, like things would get out of control or anything like that. I would never advise anyone, you know, to have this experience on their own either. I think it's absolutely essential that you have a guide. In terms of, you know, drugs and all of that, I will say that in my childhood, you know, my father was really big into drugs, so I'm a really anti-drug person. So to really go into this study at all, I had to, you know, see the research and understand that this isn't a drug like that. This is a potential medication.
And you want, ultimately, you said, you're getting straight A's now in school, whereas previously you weren't able to order food at a restaurant or make a phone call. Do you, you said you hoped to be part of an effort to help other people. How impatient are you about this? And are you willing to wait for the kind of research that these other doctors are saying is going to be necessary?
Well, of course I am. Of course. I mean, I think it all the research needs to happen. The science needs to be there. And everybody needs to know that it's, you know, completely safe for a wide range of people. And I'm just, you know, like I said, I'm taking 18 hours at a time, and I'll just keep going until I get there. I mean, my dream is to be a psychotherapist and work with MAPS to further their goals.
MAPS, one of the organizations that's funding this research, which is so difficult apparently to get money for. So let me go back to Tom Schroeder on that issue. Once again, the author of Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal, the first guest on our program in the first half. What about raising more money as the kind of with the kind of programs we're having today become more common? Do you think that there will be greater interest, even though, because it appears that this doesn't have to be a continuing kind of treatment, there isn't a lot of money in it for the big drug companies?
Well, and also these drugs aren't patentable. So, you know, they really would not be that expensive when used as prescription drugs. And, you know, I think that this is moving ahead, and I think that inevitably, if these results hold, and, you know, as a non-researcher, I can say just from, you know, having the freedom to speak freely, is that I think that they clearly will hold through phase three. But it's just a matter of how long it's going to take. And it's such a shame to think that this could take like another 10 or so years. And, you know, it could be sped up. The FDA could give it a special status for an urgently required drug. The government, through the Department of Defense or otherwise, could help the funding. So, you know, they do things like Indiegogo campaigns to raise money, you know, $10, $20 at a time from individual donors. So they're increasing the amount of, and they're getting some major donors from some wealthy people who think that this is an important deal. But let me just say about the other thing, all these studies that have been approved by the FDA, the cautions that they build into them have to be there, otherwise the study would never have proved. They have to do elaborate screening to make sure that people with histories of psychiatric disturbance are not included in these programs, or people with with high blood pressure, et cetera, that could be exacerbated by this drug. And you know, and the working with the patients as in a safe environment with people who are trained to do this is an essential part of the program. And none of these clinical trials would be approved with somebody doing something reckless, you know, like some people did back in the 60s, where you just sort of give it to somebody out in the woods somewhere and let them run around. That's not being contemplated by anybody, and it certainly would never pass muster with the FDA.
Charles Grove, back to you at Harbor UCLA Medical Center, working to determine whether there is, in fact, medical use for these drugs. Talk a little bit about the climate we're in terms of marijuana. First, it was medical marijuana. Now it's recreational marijuana in Colorado and in Washington. People in surrounding states are complaining that all of a sudden marijuana is coming into their states, even though it's not legal there. Is that, do you think, going to lead to another backlash that might have an impact on the loosening up of of the controls we have now on the drugs we're talking about?
I think the growing interest in medical marijuana is going to spur interest in medical application of, you know, a variety of substances that have previously been illicit. So I think that may encourage greater interest. In terms of this research somehow provoking more recreational use, we haven't seen any indication of that to date, and I don't necessarily expect that's going to be the case. These are not new substances. They've been around for a long time. Anyone who wants to get them, people seem to be able to access them through whatever means. I don't think, though, that the these approved research studies will catalyze more recreational use.
Back to Dr. Kleber at Columbia University. Are you concerned, given what's happened with recreational marijuana, that there might be once again a backlash of some sort, or that there could be abuses?
Well, there's no question that if these drugs become as freely available as marijuana, which is unlikely but possible, that there will be problems.
Right, but what I'm asking is, will the what's happening with marijuana itself have something to do with the greater or lesser acceptance of the kind of research we're talking about?
Yes, but remember, there's already a backlash in some places about marijuana.
Yeah.
That, for example, I think a number of counties now in Colorado have banned medical marijuana or recreational marijuana, so that, and that's with a lot of people using it and wanting it, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to be careful. And these drugs have one particular danger that marijuana doesn't have, and that is they often take away the fear of death, which can be coped with in a controlled setting like Dr. Grobe or Dr. Griffith or Ross carry out. But in an unsupervised session, the loss of the fear of death can be very, very scary.
So, Tom Schroeder, final question to you. Politics are certainly going to play a role in this.
Oh, there's no question. And we're going to see that really after the phase three. When it comes time, see, before they can make it a prescription drug, they'll have to reclassify it. And that's when the political situation will come up. And, you know, it's hard to say, is that going to be 6 years in the future or 10 years in the future? But at some point, the political authorities are going to be asked to say, okay, you need to make these drugs no longer Schedule One. And I think we're going to still see the residual sort of fear of these drugs that's really quite irrational, considering that many of the drugs that are already used as prescription drugs are far more dangerous than these drugs are.
Okay, subject for another program. Thank you all very much for being on this one. Tom Schroeder again, Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal, a new book. Good to have you on our program. Thanks to Charles Grobe at Harbor UCLA Medical Center, who is experimenting with psychedelic drugs. Thanks to Dr. Herbert Kleber at Columbia University. And thank you, Jennifer. Once again, that's a pseudonym for our 30-year-old guest, who suffered from PTSD and as a result of very careful treatment with ecstasy is now able to get straight A's in school and live not just a normal life, but a happy one as well. Great to have all of you on our program. Thank you very much for being with us. Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has lifted the nighttime curfew in the city of Baghdad, imposed by the U.S. military 12 years ago. In a moment, we'll talk to a veteran reporter who says the city already is showing some small signs of revival. On To the Point.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
We're on Alni back with today's talking point. Baghdad feels different. That's according to Liz Sly, Beirut bureau chief for The Washington Post, who's back in Iraq to cover what she calls a surprising revival of the normal life so violently disrupted more than a decade ago. Liz Sly, it's always good to hear from you. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello. How are you?
How is Baghdad different?
Baghdad feels completely different. I spent many years here before, as you know, covering the war, covering many phases of the war. I was last here 6 months ago. When I came back here a little over a week ago, I immediately noticed this enormous difference. There were just so many people out on the streets, so many restaurants lit up, so many new venues, so many people drinking alcohol, which is something we didn't see for many years in Baghdad. Alcohol is a central point of some of this new revival that you're seeing, this new social life that you're seeing. And I really just felt that Iraqis are starting to relax in their capital for the first time in a really long time.
Aren't there those still car bombs in Baghdad?
There are car bombs, but they are far, far fewer than they used to be. We used to have waves of car bombs. They used to be almost every day at one point, or you would get like a week where there would be three or four a day, like it was a campaign, then there'd be a lull. You're getting one or two here and there now. It's nothing like it used to be.
Why do you think the curfew was lifted?
Well, I think possibly the curfew has been in place for too long already. It's a little bit demeaning to Iraqis to make them go home at midnight over these past few years when not that much was going on. There's no real reason to believe car bombs are going to go off in the middle of the night any more than they are in the middle of the day. But Prime Minister Badi has come to office promising to make improvements, promising to ease life for people, promising to make a difference from his predecessor. So it was a very obvious move for him to make, make this gesture. And also they cited the noticeable improvement in the security situation.
What about the country outside of Baghdad? How far does this extend, as far as you can tell? You've only been in Baghdad, I take it.
I've traveled outside, and indeed very little has changed outside the capital, and you've got war fronts as little as 30 miles away, so there's fighting all around the capital. And indeed, there's a sense that perhaps this is something of a wartime phenomenon. People sort of partying while they can because the country's at war. There's a real feeling of emergency going on, but why not have a good time while you can?
Describe in a little more detail how it is that Iraqis are having a good time. What are they doing, and under what circumstances are they, for example, consuming alcohol?
Well, liquor stores became a huge bone of contention after the U.S. military took over. People who tried to open their stores would find that they were bombed by the militias or the insurgents or somebody. Now they're everywhere. Almost every street has a liquor store. They're open all day. It's really not hard to find alcohol at all. You also have this proliferation of clubs, nightclubs. They're all over the place. They're not nightclubs that you would think of perhaps in American terms. They're sort of like bars where men go and smoke and drink and girls dance and they look at the girls and the girls sing. But they're everywhere. And it was something that really was frowned upon until very, very recently.
Does this mean, then, that there is no presence of any sort of religious police, as we've heard about in so many places?
Well, you used to have these militias who would, in a rather sinister way, kind of blow things up or take protection money or seek to suppress these things. But a lot of these militias are now out on the front lines fighting ISIS. And perhaps they're too busy to clamp down on people back home. Perhaps they've decided it's in their interest to make life nice for people in Baghdad, not to bother them so that people feel happy with the new situation. But whatever it is, the whole city just feels more relaxed, and people are taking advantage of that.
How long has this been going on, as far as you can tell?
Well, when I left in July, the last time, the whole city was pretty much shut down. Very nervous of ISIS, very nervous of the new presence of the militias on the streets. People I spoke to, another thing that people do is they go and hang out on the riverbank and on the bridges at night with cans of beer. That's the people who can't afford to go to clubs and buy drinks in the clubs. They go and hang out outdoors and drink, and it's a huge thing. Huge crowds of cars and guys come, and they all say they've been doing it for a couple of months. I think this improvement has only been noticeable for the past 2 to 3 months, people tell me. And So it really is something linked to this new circumstance we have, and people definitely date it to the change of government from Abadi to from Maliki to Abadi.
You indicated earlier that you thought the curfew had simply gone on too long. What was the original reason for imposing it, and has the fact that it's gone on so long been a political issue in Iraq?
No, Iraqis have got so used to it. I think they'd be kind of, they're quite sort of startled that it's being lifted, but also quite overjoyed. It's just become like a de rigueur kind of thing. You have a curfew because there are bombers and because the country's not safe. But they did lift it on one occasion, which was New Year's Eve this year, and the response was overwhelming. People have told me about this. Thousands of Iraqis thronged the central square where Saddam's statue used to stand. A Christmas tree was put on the plinth where his statue had stood. People danced around the statue. They drank. They sang songs. There was dancing in the street until dawn, and it really sounds like it was quite an occasion. So I think people are very, very happy to see this curfew go.
Is it just the men dancing, drinking, and looking at the girls who are dancing, or are there ways that families also can go out now that they haven't been able to do before?
Yes, Baghdad, Iraq is a very conservative society. Women aren't encouraged to go out at night and go out drinking in these clubs or hanging out by the river at all. But there are lots of restaurants and families are out, and there's also a pretty fancy new mall, which is large, and there's lots of food, different food outlets there, and there's rides for the families. People love that. The queues to get into the mall go for miles. And there's lots of restaurants on the river. There's a boat on the Tigris that chugs up and down and serves food. And everybody's going out. It's not just the men.
Are people concerned that this might not last, that it might take just one car bomb in the wrong place to bring back the curfew?
I think Iraq is so steeled to car bombs that one car bomb in the wrong place won't end this. But a series of them, a wave of them, definitely could. And people indeed are worried that it won't last. Nobody does believe it's going to last. And when I told my Iraqi friends I was going to write a story about how lovely the atmosphere was, how happy everybody seemed, they said you'd better write it soon.
So there is then still a sense of uncertainty about what the future might hold.
You've got ISIS still in like a big chunk of the country. You've got Shia militias fighting them. You've got no resolution of the political situation. You've got no reconciliation. None of the really big political issues confronting this country have been solved. Nothing has been solved. The war isn't over. The violence isn't over. But right now, Iraqis are enjoying themselves.
Again, Liz Sly, back in Baghdad, and now Washington Bureau, Washington Post bureau chief in Beirut. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
To the Point, produced this week by Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Benjamin Gottlieb, Jenny Hamill, and Sasha Woodruff. Our technical director is Joel Stein, senior producer Evan George, managing producer Sonia Geis. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.